Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Our topic this hour is the role of women in the Black Lives Matter movement. Recent police shootings of black men have sparked outrage at a national movement against police brutality and racial injustice. Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, and Michael Brown, to name a few, have become familiar names in the media and in the public consciousness. Despite women playing a dominant role in the creation and leadership of Black Lives Matter, police violence against black women has been largely overlooked. Police killings of black women such as Redell Jones, Natasha McKenna, and Rekia Boyd have failed to result in convictions. This lack of attention to and accountability for the violence perpetrated against black women and girls has raised concern about the invisibility of the experiences of black women when it comes to the cause for racial justice. Tonight we discuss black women's experience of police violence. How is it similar and different from that experienced by black men in this country? Why is police brutality against black women largely ignored? What is the impact of the silence around this issue on black women, their families and communities, and the larger Black Lives Matter movement? And finally, what is being done to ensure the fight against racial injustice is more gender inclusive? Joining me in the studio this evening to discuss these issues and more is Kamau Walton, a member of the Black Lives Matter Bay Area and Critical Resistance, a movement focused on ending the prison industrial complex. Kamau was the lead coordinator in the movement to stop Urban Shield and increased militarization in Bay Area communities of color. They've also served as one of the leaders in the successful fight to end civil gang injunctions in Oakland and abolish solitary confinement during and following the historic prisoner hunger strikes in California in 2011 and 2013. Welcome, Kamau.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
And joining us by phone, first we have Rachel Ansbach. She's a writer, activist, and intersectional feminist. Her works focus on combating intersectional marginalization and the erasure of women of color from social justice work, policy, and media coverage. She previously served as senior writer-editor at the African American Policy Forum, where she co-authored Say Her Name, Resisting Police Brutality Against Black Women. Welcome, Rachel.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, by phone, we're joined by Dr. Marsha Chatlin. She's an associate professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown University. She's also the author of Southside Girls, Growing Up in the Great Migration. She is the creator and host of Office Hours, a podcast where she talks to her students about what is most important to them, from the ups and downs of college life to popular culture and social activism. She also instructs educators and parents on how to talk to children about race and the national crisis. Welcome, Dr. Chatlin.
Thank you.
And as always, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. The number to dial is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, Rachel Ansbach, I wanted to start with you. Tell us a little bit more about what you and your co-authors of the Say Her Name report found out about the prevalence of police brutality against black women.
Yeah, definitely. So we knew that police were killing black women every year. In 2015, some of the cis and trans black women and girls who were killed by the police or who experienced other forms of police brutality included Alexia Christian, Megan Hockaday, Natasha McKenna, Maya Hall, and India Kager. And then, as you mentioned in your intro, we also know that not only is this a phenomenon that's not really being given adequate attention by the media or by social movements, but they're also experiencing the same forms of a lack of accountability at the hands of the state. So also in 2015, the police officer who killed the sleeping 7-year-old Ayanna Stanley Jones and the officer who shot Rekia Boyd in the back of the head were both cleared of all charges. The officers who killed Maya Hall, a black transgender woman in Baltimore, weren't even charged. And then in December of last year, we saw Daniel Holtzclaw, who was convicted of 18 counts of rape and sexual assault of black women while in the course of duty as a police officer in Oklahoma City. He was convicted of about half of the charges he faced, and yet that receive very little media coverage or public outcry. So this pattern we were seeing of this violence happening and also being erased from conversations around policing and injustice was what prompted us to decide to write the Say Her Name report. So the goal of the report was both to uplift the names and the stories of Black women and girls who experienced police brutality, and then also to present some analytical frames through which the movement can understand this violence and hopefully move toward agitating around it more, which I think we have seen it's been a little over a year since the report was released.
And so what was the response to the report? It seems like it's shedding light on the experiences of Black women when it comes to police brutality, but also seems to point some fingers at the discourse at the larger level, both media and within the organizations that are trying to get attention for racial injustice when it comes to police action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we launched the report in May of 2015 at the same time as we held a vigil in remembrance of Black women killed by police in Union Square, and that for the first time brought together family members of several Black women from across the country who had been killed by police. And that was where the Say Her Name hashtag like really first took off and started to receive a lot of attention, and then I think it kind of snowballed after the public really took notice of Sandra Bland's death in July of last year. So I think that the report and the surrounding campaign has changed the discourse, and we've seen it taken up by a lot of activists and groups across the country. And actually, I think, obviously, there's always more work to do, but a focus on Black women and girls, and also on transgender and gender nonconforming Black folks is really centered in the Movement for Black Lives policy platform that was released today. So I think like activists have been really trying to take this up, and now a lot of it will be up to the media and to policymakers to see whether they can make actual changes to the status quo.
So a lot of what was written in your report speaks to the fact that there just isn't a lot of data out there to mm-hmm. be able to track this. Where did you get the information that you compiled?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, it was very difficult to find the data. Currently, police departments are not required to submit data on police killings. It's submitted on a voluntary basis to the FBI, which leads to a drastic undercounting of police killings and police misconduct across the board. And this is exacerbated when it comes to Black women, because no one was really, especially when we were in the stages of writing the report, this was something that no one was really talking about. So it was actually very difficult to find even like the names or the stories of these women, even when I was digging for them. So I was basically just looking for what I could find online, or like I would hear a snippet of something from another activist and then dig until I found that. And I was finding that when I was looking for these stories, there was almost no media coverage, and what stories there would be would basically just be a couple little snippets from local news outlets that would basically just regurgitate the police line, and oftentimes would not speak to family members or advocates for families. So I think the lack of media coverage, obviously the lack of government accountability and like reporting on these occurrences is a huge problem, but so is the lack of media coverage.
So you mentioned several names of Black women who were killed by police. How else is the experience of Black women when it comes to their interactions with police the same or different compared with Black men or other men of color?
Mm-hmm. So I think, right, there are ways in which all Black Americans are criminalized, by the police, and also there's a general perception, I think that's been backed up by studies, that Black people are viewed as possessing superhuman strength. So this impacts all Black Americans in their or it has the potential to impact all Black Americans in their interactions with law enforcement. And I think what we saw specifically a lot when it came to women is that this could lead officers to use undue physical force in cases where they were actually called for support when a woman was having a mental health crisis or a domestic violence crisis. Instead of offering the compassionate support that the woman needed, they would in fact view her as a threat and use physical force that I just cannot imagine having been used on a white woman. So we saw this with Kayla Moore, with Michelle Cousteau, with Tanisha Anderson. And then at the same time, there are stereotypes that uniquely are applied to Black women. So the view of Black women as unfit mothers, as welfare queens, or as being sexually promiscuous and unrapeable in a way, can justify sexual assault by police officers, as we saw in the Daniel Holtzclaw case, or the criminalization and kind of blame placing on Black women in instances where they're actually the victims themselves.
And so what you're saying is that there's a much broader set of experiences than what we've been seeing, not only that's been focused only on men, but there's a whole other set of abuses by police that is gender specific for African-American women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think another large dimension of this is that a lot of the stories that have taken hold, like in the movement and in the media, are instances where police brutality or police shootings are caught on tape or where they take place in public spaces. But a lot of the police brutality that Black women experience, in fact, takes place in private spaces. A lot of it happens when, as I mentioned, police are first responders, when women are having a crisis. And since the social safety net hardly exists for a lot of Americans anymore, police are increasingly first responders in crises. So a lot of the women whose stories we included in the Say Her Name report experienced police brutality or were killed by police in their own homes or in other private spaces.
So that's Rachel Ansbach, and she is co-author of the Say Her Name report that talks about examples, underreported examples of police brutality against Black women. We'll hear more from Rachel as the hour unfolds. I want to turn next to Kamau Walton here in the studio with me, a member of Black Lives Matter Bay Area and Critical Resistance, to talk about sort of the on-the-ground experience and how what you hear and see and are trying to organize around dovetails with what Rachel has reported.
Yeah, so I think in taking into consideration the roles of Black women, both in organizing and both as a call to action when Black women are facing violence, there are moments where we have done that really well, and there are moments where we struggle to sustain the attention and the momentum to get justice, whatever that looks like for particular folks. So locally, I'm thinking about Yvette Henderson, who was killed by the Emeryville Police Department just outside of the Home Depot near the Emeryville Shopping Center. And she was chased and shot down with military-grade weapons. And people organized Black Lives Matter Bay Area, the Anti-Police Terror Project, as well as another Black organizing group called Black Seed, and shut down the Home Depot there. And there has been continued work to demilitarize and disarm the Emeryville Police Department, which is still going strong, but it has not garnered nearly as much attention as other local struggles. And when talking about the impacts of policing on folks in the East Bay or the Bay Area as a whole, hasn't pulled nearly as much attention. But I think you know, for the folks that are in the midst of the organizing, these instances of police violence, because we did have lots of conversations about Daniel Holtzclaw. We did talk about Yvette Henderson. A lot of the people that are involved in the organizing are survivors of a wide variety of both state and interpersonal violence. It pushes us to have a stronger resolve to continue to do the work. And it also pushes us to think more creatively around what justice and accountability looks like, especially when trying to garner that from institutions that were built on exploiting, caging, and murdering Black bodies. It's hard to think about what justice looks like just explicitly thinking within the realm of policing and courts and prisons. And we're also trying to expand that conversation to think about what healing looks like for our communities, which I think is a really interesting facet of the work, in addition to the organizing and the resistance and the on-the-ground protest, because I think the role of Black women historically as healers has been such a key part of Black community in the U.S. and globally. And is a key part in keeping us resilient, both organizers and community members as a whole.
So you said something earlier in your comments about how you've been able to focus on the examples of police brutality or police killing of Black women, but that it's been difficult to sustain that attention. Why is that? And do you see that as particularly different from the attention being sustained on similar experiences of Black men?
So I think it's for several reasons. One, Emeryville Police Department is not as much of a major player in local organizing struggles as thinking about like the Oakland Police Department or the San Francisco Police Department. And so it's a little farther out there. Two, Black people get murdered every 28 hours. And so it's just it's hard to keep up with the pace of the amount of death that's happening.
And you mean murdered by police every 28 hours?
By police every 28 hours, yes. Thank
okay.
you.
Yeah.
And I think it's also what Rachel was saying is that a lot of these instances of murders of Black women are not being on tape. They're not in public places. And so there are groups like the Anti-Police Terror Project who tend to be first responders to police murders, who try to collect the stories of folks in the area as quickly as possible. So it's not just the police or local officials giving the stories, but it's also people in the community. But it's really hard to carry those stories forward without having the video or the Facebook post or something like that. Yeah.
So I want to bring in Marsha Chatlin from Georgetown University. So Marsha, what's your take on why there's not more attention, or there seems to be a need for more effort to get attention for concerns around police brutality towards Black women? What's your take on a national stage?
Well, I think your guests really outlined some of the key issues. I think that the fact that so much violence against women happens in spaces that are not only out of public view, but also are not sites of memorialization to stand as symbols for resistance against police violence, I think helps exacerbate this problem. But I think at the core, sexism and misogyny is very real, and even in the face of state violence or violence that is similar to the violence that male bodies encounter, there's just a fundamental devaluation of women's pain. And so I think that part of the narrative of men of color being the only real victims of police violence is a sense that the loss of a male life is worth more than the loss of a female life. And I think that when you have a culture that's so steeped in these ideologies, the ability to really register Black women's pain becomes very difficult. And so what we're seeing right now is these deeply embedded ideas informing one of the most important public conversations we've had in this country. And so I think that efforts like Say Her Name and the real intentionality of the leaders of Black Lives Matter is really, an important step in resisting that kind of erasure.
And when you say the sexism and misogyny, are you speaking of media primarily? Are you talking about the organizing movements as well, broader?
I'm talking about the entire culture. I mean, I think that I'm indicting all of it, because it shapes the stories that, you know, media will seek out. It shapes the way that movements decide to galvanize people. And so I think that in confronting police violence, we're confronting misogyny and sexism and transphobia in that process as well. And so I think that you start to see the residual effects of having a fundamental inability to recognize the full humanity of women and girls.
So Rachel or Kamau, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think I definitely agree with what she said, and I think culture shifting is a big part of the work of Black Lives Matter, nationally and locally here as well. If you look at our political principles, we name misogyny and male-centeredness as some of the things that we are not centering in our spaces. We definitely raise up Black trans women, because Black trans women, if we're looking at, so the whole argument for Black Lives Matter is that it's not just about, it's not saying that all lives don't matter, but we're saying Black lives are the ones that are being the most persecuted. And when we're looking within the Black community, thinking about the folks within our community that are being the most persecuted, that are facing the most marginalization and repression from the state, we're looking at women, we're looking at girls, we're looking at trans and gender nonconforming folks too. And so that is one of the ways that we are trying to lift up and center those struggles. And it's also been one of the reasons why we have gotten a significant amount of pushback, even just on Friday at a community film screening. I had a very long conversation with some folks that were talking about the fact that we talk too much about trans people and women, and it makes Black men not feel welcome in our spaces, even though we do have Black men in our chapter and in chapters across the country. And it's been a really great conversation starter to get folks to acknowledge that even though we do face a lot of similar struggles within the Black community, there are those of us who do have certain levels of privilege, being cisgendered, being working class, being male or heterosexual, and we need to figure out how to hold those in ways that lift up people who don't have those privileges. And that means centering Black trans women and the experiences of Black women as well.
Well, that raised the question in my mind is how does this attempt to broaden the inclusivity of the Black Lives Matter movement and broaden the conversation, how do you keep it, how do you help it, how do you harness it to help give more energy to the movement rather than causing splintering to occur?
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily splintering. I think it's having tough conversations with people. Even with the folks I've been organizing with for the last 2 years with Black Lives Matter, like we don't necessarily always agree on things. And so it's continuing to have those conversations to reach common ground. It's pushing ourselves to be uncomfortable in this work because it's, you know, it's called the struggle. You know, it's not called recess. It's going to be hard and uncomfortable sometimes. And it's getting folks to have conversations that wouldn't necessarily, because there are subgroups and subcultures in all communities, really. And it's trying to build the bridges so that we can connect, because whether you're a Black trans woman or you're a straight Black man, like, people want affordable housing, people want job security, people want to be able to walk through the streets safely. And we might be fearful of not having those things for different reasons, but we need to come together in order to achieve them.
Marsha Chatelain, what does it say to you that, you know, Black Lives Matter was started by three women, and it sounds like there's fighting for space here to make sure that creating space that includes women in the coverage and in the organizing around this. What does this tell you?
Well, I think that what it says to me as a historian is that Black Lives Matter is part of a history of struggle in this country, in which women have done the heavy lifting but have been silenced and moved to the back. And Black Lives Matter and its articulation and its bold leadership is destabilizing that long history. So the resistance to women articulating Their position within larger movements for racial justice has always been a site of tension. But what we see with Black Lives Matter is a different model of doing that kind of organizing and consciously trying to resist that sexist impulse that can happen in a lot of communities. And so I'm really excited to think about all the books and the projects and all of the reflections on Black Lives Matter, because it's bringing both the past and the future together in our moments. And it's really inspiring to see these organizers who are so steeped in the mistakes that many movements have made and really actively trying to change that.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the Black Lives Matter movement, specifically the role of women and the lack of media attention to the experiences of Black women when it comes to police violence and brutality. We're meeting tonight with guests Rachel Ansbach, writer, activist, intersectional feminist, and previous senior writer-editor at the African American Policy Forum, Dr. Marcia Chatelain. She's associate professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown University. And here with me in the studio is Kamau Walton, member of Black Lives Matter Bay Area and Critical Resistance. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Have you or someone you know been subject to police brutality, especially if it's a woman? Let us know how it's impacted you. What was the repercussions for this violence? And what do you think about this conversation about trying to expand the awareness of police brutality to include concerns about women? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You could also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KLW website or tweet us at CityVisionsKALW. So, Rachel, did you have something to add there? I couldn't tell if it was you or Marcia who responded a little bit to what Kamau was saying.
I think responding to what Kamau was saying about kind of the pushback to censoring women and trans folks, I feel like we experienced that a lot also at the African American Policy Forum, both through Say Her Name and then our Black Girls Matter campaign, which was uplifting the ways in which Black girls can be pushed onto the school-to-prison pipeline and criminalized, which is also very related. And I feel like, an argument that we would try to use a lot and that can maybe help bring people in is this idea that centering all the forms of police brutality that Black Americans face actually kind of brings us more toward a systemic framework that allows us to maybe address more root causes rather than a focus solely on Black men. Because a lot of times when conversations around racial inequality focus solely on Black men, it's very easy to for like politicians or the media to paint that as something is wrong with Black men and we need to fix them. And when we actually highlight all the like the full breadth and scope of the ways in which Black Americans are criminalized and in which their lives are stolen by agents of the state, that allows us to see that we really need to indict the system as a whole.
So I think what we've done is backed ourselves into the definition of intersectionality. Did I get that right? It's a term that's relatively new to me. So tell us a little bit more about that and how that's important to the conversation we're having tonight.
Yeah, sure. So intersectionality was a term coined by Kimberly Crenshaw, who is a legal scholar and the director of the African American Policy Forum, which published the Say Her Name report. And she first coined the term, over 25 years ago now, in reference to her work on a legal case, DeGraff and Reed versus General Motors, in which Black women sued General Motors because jobs reserved for Black employees were just being given to men, and jobs reserved for women were just being given to white women. And the court actually dismissed the case on the basis that Black women couldn't combine their race and gender claims into one. So Kim Crenshaw, in her thinking about how unjust that was, first coined the term intersectionality, and then since then it's kind of the use of an intersectional lens has really broadened and expanded and taken on a life of its own, and it's become really central to, I think, a lot of movements for justice in the U.S. and across the world. So it was through that lens that we definitely took that lens when working on the Say Her Name report.
So it's sort of finding or defining common ground based on overlapping or separate demographics as opposed to kind of keeping them as separate fights.
So it's basically like the idea that different aspects of an individual's identity overlap and interact with power structures in society in unique ways. So, like, a cis Black woman will experience different forms of marginalization from a trans Black woman, different from a cis Black man, et cetera.
Okay. And Marcia Chatelain, let's talk about, at a larger level, what is the impact, if we weren't to have this conversation tonight, what would be the impact on this movement, on the larger movement for racial justice in this country, if we don't include these stories?
What we do is we create another generation of people with blinders on, who are not able to see fully how power works and how structural inequality operates in different modes. And so I think that what we do is we have an incomplete picture of not only the problems, but also we can't have a really sound vision of what the future can be unless we really think about the various fault lines that happen inside and outside of our communities. And so I just feel very fortunate to live in this moment where activism is so robust, it's so creative, and it's so clear that gender equity and gender justice is not a negotiable, it's not something to put on the table and bargain with, that it stands at the center of answering some very important questions. And so I think we do know what happens when people don't ask those questions. We see the limits of freedom struggles, we see struggles that are torn apart, we see the damage that happens when sexual violence and gender inequality happens even within activist circles. So we have so many lessons, and it's really beautiful to see those lessons put into action in a new generation.
Can you say more about that, about the lessons learned from the historical lens that you use to understand where movements went wrong in the past when they drew lines that were more exclusive than inclusive?
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, we can point to the very classic example of the civil rights struggles of the 1950s and 60s, where you see so much work being done by women, and you see women who are also being jailed, women who are targets of sexual violence, women who are really carrying the load for communities when men are incarcerated. And you see all this work, and it's always distilled in these, in a popular sense, women in the civil rights movement are reduced to a few figures who do things that are often portrayed out of context. I mean, Rosa Parks is a classic example, where her radicalism, where her work on behalf of women who are victims of sexual violence, all of that history is flattened, and she becomes the nice old lady on the bus. And so I think that we have these stories now, we have historians and we have scholars who are writing new stories of women in the civil rights movement, and it allows for us to remember that we have to look at the larger picture of what motivates someone, of how they change in their activist style, and that if we just change our lens slightly and allow for us to see the women like Ella Baker, like Fannie Lou Hamer, in their wholeness, I think it inspires more people to believe that they can make a difference. We are no longer in an era where activists have to be heroes, and we're no longer in an era where victims of violence have to be saints. We are dealing with people as they are in their fullness and their complexity, and more I think people see that, the more and more that they know that they also have gifts to bring to the movement.
Kamau?
Oh, yes, I was just nodding my head emphatically. I think it's very true. that we are pushing ourselves to think more holistically, not just about the identities of folks that we are organizing with and that are a part of our communities, but also about the expansiveness of the different types of state violence that people face simultaneously, which is definitely pushing us to put out things like the Movement for Black Lives platform that just went out today, covering, you know, everything from fossil fuels to school-to-prison pipelines.
So you're saying that as you get more inclusive, it begets more inclusion. It just keeps growing.
Yeah, I think when you're thinking, even if we're just going to look specifically at the prison industrial complex, that is not just policing and imprisonment. That's also court systems. That's also collaboration with school districts. That's also surveillance cameras all across our cities. And so it is a huge system that impacts us in a wide variety of ways, and it's not just when we interact with the cop, but it's also when we're being surveilled on Facebook. And so it definitely requires us to think holistically about the ways that state violence is articulated, whether that's, you know, facing police repression at a stop point or, you know, Facebook censoring what we actually post on there in regards to our political dissent.
And this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and there we were hearing from Kamau Walton, member of Black Lives Matter Bay Area and Critical Resistance. Earlier, we were hearing from Dr. Marcia Chatlin, Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Georgetown University, and Rachel Ansbach, writer, activist, intersectional feminist, and previous senior writer editor at the African American Policy Forum. We invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation about the role of Black women in the Black Lives Matter movement and the larger movement for racial justice in this country. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So we have an email here from Sam. And Sam states, what are we doing on a national level to address racial and gender injustice? What policies are being changed? Has the Obama administration addressed this topic? So who among you would like to take a stab at these questions?
So I will say first that I really want to highlight and push the political platform. It's called Visions for Black Lives that just came out from the Movement for Black Lives, which is an umbrella coalition of over 50 organizations that focus on Black communities across the country. It has 39 points on there. It also highlights current legislation that's happening as well as suggested legislation, the organizations that are doing the work, and a lot of times really informational articles. It is extensive and very thorough and a good point for folks to get a lot more information about what's happening on the ground and some future ideas for possible working campaigns in the future.
Rachel or Marcia?
I think one of the things that's interesting is I personally can't recall a single policy that is really targeted at looking at the specific challenges that Black women and girls face, and I think that's saying a lot. But I do know this, that when we look at a lot of these issues around justice for Black women and girls, we have to also look at the disparate treatment in schools and in juvenile facilities and prisons. And so we're at a point where there isn't even a clear standard to give women, you know, sanitary supplies when they're in. And there isn't very clear guidelines on educational opportunities. We don't have federal legislation on shackling women who are delivering a baby while incarcerated. So we have all of these very gender-specific issues that disproportionately impact women of color that have not been brought into these systems. And so I think that that's why this platform is so important, because it's allowing us through that gendered lens to say it's not just about reforming X or Y, but it's also being attentive to the fact that men and women experience these institutions so differently.
And I'm curious, if we were to be able as a media to embrace this more and sustain the attention, I'm wondering if there are people out there saying, well, you know, is this really happening as much to women as it's happening to black men? What would be the response to that, since we don't have the data, number one? And number two, what would it mean for the larger struggle to be able to make space and to speak to this issue of the experiences, the specific experiences, the gendered experiences of black women?
Well, one of the things I just want to say, when we talk about what something, who this is happening to, we can't forget that there are entire families and communities left behind as a result of state violence. And so while we can say that men may be more likely to be victims of police violence, when we look at the impact of who is left behind to pick up the pieces, we start to see the collateral damage that women absorb. And so I think that we have to have a very broad vision of what does it mean to be a victim of this kind of violence, because it is not just the person who has died. It's the entire community that takes up the act of grieving, the act of child rearing, the act of persevering in the face of all of this grief and anxiety. And so I think that when we look at it from that perspective, we start to really see the disproportionate impact of the women who are alive and who have to carry the load.
So I want to turn in the next 15 or so minutes that is left in the program to talk about how do we actually operationalize some of these attempts to get more attention for the experiences of black women in this society, whether it's at the level of police violence and brutality or other ways in which they are experiencing structural racism and inequality. So you talked there, Kamau, about the 39 or so planks in the platform. Mm-hmm. What does it take to get it from a document to action?
Oh, well, I imagine it's going to take quite a lot. I think for a lot of the folks that have plugged into Black Lives Matter, as well as other organizations across the country, especially in the last 2 or 3 years, folks have been really used to doing a lot of on-the-ground organizing, a lot of direct actions, a lot of civil disobedience and different kinds of nonviolent protests. And this is pushing us to do a combination of that as well as thinking about what the legislative work looks like. I think it also means doing a lot of community building and political education within our communities across the board, so that we have a strong understanding, as was mentioned earlier, of not just the handful of systems that impact us, but the systems holistically that are impacting black folks, whether it's black women, black trans people, black folks with disabilities, and thinking about how we move everything forward collectively, which I think is a really beautiful piece to the platform, is that this is a holistic push to improve the lives of black folks across this country, therefore improving the lives of all people in this country. But I think it's going to be multiple levels of action campaigns with legislative work that are building up the self-determination and political power of individuals in our communities, in addition to, you know, writing these bills out and pushing forward the ones that are already in the works.
And Rachel, what do you see as the key steps to really expanding the focus to be able to include the experiences of black women?
Mm-hmm. Well, first off, I want to step back and point out that it's really unfortunate and unfair that the responsibility for changing the conversation and for changing these unjust policies is falling on activists and on victims, who are often the ones who are experiencing this violence on a daily basis and the ones who are being oppressed by structures in our society. So it's definitely an unfair burden placed on activists that, you know, ideally it should be those in power and those, like, politicians and members of the mainstream media who are the ones who are actually changing these power structures to be more just, but instead it's falling on activists. But I think when it comes to recognizing and centering women in the fight against police brutality, you know, one thing that remains, and I think I appreciated Marcia kind of calling out the culture of misogyny. One reality that remains is that even with all the increased attention that women's stories have garnered, I can't think of one woman who was killed by the police or who experienced another form of police brutality who was mourned or remembered with public outpourings on the levels of many Black men who have been killed by police, such as Eric Garner, Mike Brown, or even recently Alton Sterling and Philando Castile. And yet there have been many women whose stories have been equally unjust and horrific and whose lives were stolen equally for no good reason. So I think that would be a big step to start seeing women's stories garnering the same level of attention and the same level of protest.
So I take your point about, you know, whose responsibility is this to start changing. But given where we're at right now, what would organizations need to do to really get that the word out there, the images out there, whatever it is that's going to capture the attention of the media and politicians and others and the community at large?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I definitely don't have all the answers, but I think that a lot of the work that organizations and activists across the country are doing is work that simply is not going to garner attention from mainstream media. It's not glamorous work. It's work of really investing themselves and going deep into communities and working with community members, doing community organizing to think of alternatives to policing, to think of ways that communities can keep themselves safe and like create new schemas of accountability and justice that are grounded in love for each other and kind of allow them to prevent themselves from needing to involve the police in the first place. So I think that work is really hard work and it's not glamorous work, and I do think it's happening in communities across the country, but what will it take for mainstream media to cover that work? That's something I don't know, and I don't know that I realistically see happening.
A brief input there from you, Marcia, before we go to a caller.
Well, I think that, you know, I think we should do a national day without a Black woman and see how many things can happen. You know, I think a large part of what is unfortunate about what makes people kind of move to action is that we have to humanize people who are, you know, humanizing humans, unfortunately. And so I think that we have yet to find a place in the culture in which the humanity and the potential of Black women is really honored. And so I think our everyday acts of love, our everyday acts of saying names, you know, is the first step in that. But I think what we really need to do is draw out the complexity of what does it mean for Black women to carry this, to carry the weight of these problems as a first step in trying to galvanize people to really understand what is happening.
If you want to join us here in the last few minutes of our program here on KALW for City Visions tonight as we talk about women in the Black Lives Matter movement, the number to dial is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. Let's go to Rodessa in San Francisco. Rodessa, welcome to the program.
Hi. Great show, and I am so in accord with what I'm hearing. One of the most wonderful things happening here in San Francisco is we have a social movement that's growing entitled The Black Woman is God. And it is a mixture of art, rituals, religion, sculpture, and gatherings, dance, music. And right now it's running here in the city at SOMARTS. But it has been a richly a rich activity, and that I see, I know a lot of the women that are working. I'm a part of that organization, and I see that our daughters and our husbands and our sons are being affected by the whole idea of us celebrating the lives and the struggles of black women, of mothers. I have a T-shirt, "The Black Woman is God," and I've been confronted by people who either take great offense, and then I have to sort of remind them that we are the ones who have to get up off of our knees and carry on, take care of the children, clean up the blood, deal with the courts, even with the whole idea of the little girl that was killed, the little 7-year-old that was killed with that stray bullet, and nothing was done. The officer was not charged. It has got to be those women that look like her, her grandmother, the women in that community that's got to get up and carry the mother and the family that has to face the future anyway. And it really is about us loving one another. It's about us finding ways to plant the seeds of community always, and teaching our daughters and our families that we matter, that women matter, that black women matter. Yes, black lives matter, but inside of that, as all women, we tend to take care of everybody else. So I just like to say I'm appreciating listening to this conversation, and also just putting it out there that God's walk amongst us. And I don't mean that facetiously. I mean it should be taken into consideration as we move forward. The spirituality, the art, the culture, the prayers, you know, that are all a part of changing the world. You know, when you think about how Michelle Obama was questioned when she says that the White House was built by slaves, huh? It became a question, you know. Or when Cicely Tyson was living with Miles Davis, and she called the police because of the brutality in their relationship, the domestic violence. The police came in, and she was hiding in the basement, but it was Miles Davis. So the police were caught up in, oh, it's Miles. Oh, there's a woman downstairs in the basement. It's too bad she didn't have much more of a community or felt like she could talk about it without even, like, causing him stress, but just, like, being able to talk to her girlfriends, her sisters, her mothers about what's happening, and them maybe coming to him and talking. So I just want to say that it's great that we have this conversation. This is such a part of it. And we must just move forward, finding ways through the artistic process, through the ritualized everyday rhythms of our lives as a way to participate. And if and when you're in San Francisco, do see the exhibition of "The Black Woman is God."
Well, thank you so much. Thanks so much, Rodessa, for your comments.
Mm-hmm.
So Kamau, this reminds me of something you said earlier in the hour, where, you know, the focus is justice and accountability, but now it's how do you bring healing and love into this this process as well. So that is a shift, perhaps. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily an either or; it's a both and, right? I'm hearing. How do you do that? You know, the tone that has been struck is really the one around justice and accountability, and this other one, I don't know that we've heard that before, and how do we talk about it in a way that sustains attention? And
yeah, so I think the language around justice and accountability has been here for a really long time, and usually when we're saying that, we're directing it at elected officials, at people that are a part of different systems of the state, different institutions that perpetuate state violence. And I think the conversation now is starting to shift towards what does justice and accountability look like within our communities and amongst ourselves. So building up the alternatives, alternative systems outside of the ones that have been historically built on the backs of black people. And one example of that is with BYP 100, the Black Youth Project 100, their Chicago chapter. There were accusations of sexual violence, and they are in the process of developing an accountability process with the person that caused the harm, as well as the person that experienced the violence. And that is happening internally with community members and figuring out, and it's a long process and it's a hard process, and we don't have 100% clear-cut examples of what all of the solutions look like now, but people are starting to look within ourselves to get ideas of what that looks like. And when thinking about community accountability and healing circles and restorative justice, that goes back to the cultures of indigenous people, both within the Americas and in Africa and Asia. all of these groups had accountability processes before policing, before colonization. And so it's digging back into our histories, our practices, and our traditions to develop healthier and safer communities that don't depend on police or politicians.
Mm. And to this, to Marcia, how do we have this conversation with children at this time?
So one of the things that was really important to me after the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson was to help educators and parents create a framework for talking to their kids about what was happening. And what I always say is you want to be age-appropriate and climate-specific. And so although you do not want to have a small child watching these horrible videos, you know, online, what you do want to help them understand is people are upset because people have been treated unfairly. And what our responsibility in the world we live in is to try to be as fair and loving as possible. Young people can understand that framework, and as they get older and as they see and they notice inequality, they notice racial difference, they notice different economic conditions in which people are living, you can point to it and say, that is what happens with that unfairness we were talking about. And as they get older and they grow in their consciousness, they understand that the problem isn't that people are different. The problem is that people are different and treated differently because of it. And so when parents have a lot of questions about how to talk about race with the young people in their lives, I always say, explain to them that differences are a fact of life, but differences should not determine the way people live and the way that they're treated and how much love and how much support they receive.
And Rachel Ansbach, you're going to get the last word here. When it comes to documenting, reporting, recording instances of police brutality or violence towards Black women, what can people do to help correct the record?
First of all, I would urge listeners to first educate themselves about the issue. If you haven't read the Say Her Name report, it's available online. There's also some great work from other organizations on the types of police violence that Black women and trans and gender nonconforming folks face at the hands of the police, from groups including Insight and the Audre Lorde Project. I would also echo Kamau in urging folks to read the policy platform from the Movement for Black Lives. And once you feel familiar with the issue, I think we need to push for both our local police departments and at the national level a mandate on reporting police violence and reporting different kinds of police violence so that we're not just getting information on shootings, but all different types of police violence.
And in the meantime, until police departments adopt that, anything else people can do to kind of keep this conversation going?
Yeah, well, as I said, I would say educate yourself and spread the word. And then also just, I think we've seen the power of both taking videos and sharing those videos on social media and just using social media more generally to raise awareness. So if you want to do something right now, after listening to this program, you can educate yourself on these issues and you can raise awareness on social media right now.
And we'll put links on our website to the platform for the Movement for Black Lives and the Say Her Name report. You wanted to add something real quick there?
Yeah, tomorrow at 12 p.m. Pacific time, there's going to be a Twitter town hall on the hashtag Visions for the #4 Black Lives political platform. And then there will be a national call on Wednesday at 5 p.m. Pacific time. So if you look up hashtag Visions for the #4 Black Lives, you can get more information.
Great. So I want to thank my guests this evening, Rachel Ansbach, formerly of the African American Policy Forum, a writer, activist, and intersectional feminist, Dr. Marcia Chatlin, Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Georgetown University, and here in the studio with me, Kamau Walton, member of the Black Lives Matter Bay Area and Critical Resistance. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang. Please join me next week for an encore conversation with Julie Lithcott-Hames. She's the author of How to Raise an Adult. It's a book that talks about overparenting and what you can do to avoid it. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.